Welcome to the AquariMax Audio Show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 108, recorded April 9th, 2012.
Greetings, all.
Welcome once again.
Yeah, since it's like National Vampire Awareness Week or something.
Okay. No, okay. It's just National Transylvanian Accent Awareness Week.
Oh, okay.
Well, not all vampires are from Transylvania.
That's very true. I won't contest that.
I don't think the Transylvanian ones sparkle either.
Probably not. So who do we have this week?
Today we are hearing from Tony in New York and Juliet in Paris and Mick in Carnforth.
Cool. Sounds good.
But first, we're hearing from you.
Ah, from me? What am I talking about?
Well, you wanted to talk about Daphne.
Oh, yeah. I'm excited about this because, as you know, we've talked about Daphne off and on. And I culture them regularly, at any rate. I had been waiting until I could put some Daphne buckets outside and get them breeding. Well, I placed a few out there a little while ago. Not today. How long has it been? Maybe a week or so? At any rate, they are now reproducing. I looked in there yesterday and saw tiny wee Daphnia along with the adults. I hadn't placed any babies in there just to make sure that I would know when they were reproducing, and they are. So I'm happy.
It's nice that it's warm enough outside.
Yeah, there's something just very satisfactory, that feeling of knowing that you've got a Daphnia culture going outside. It's one of the signs of spring. Anyway.
You were going to tell us about what you're feeding them.
Oh, yeah. I've been testing out some different things. I know we've talked about lots of different ways to feed Daphnia. My indoor Daphnia, I've been giving a little bit of... I've been giving them spirulina, basically, for quite a while, and I have now begun to augment that with some protein powder based on green peas. And they seem to be digging it. Yeah, so...
Good.
I haven't noticed any great differences in population, but they're doing fine on it. The same, so...
We'll see if it stays the same or makes a change.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Now, was it Juliet last week who had the black
endlers?
Streak on her endlers library?
Yeah, a sudden one.
Just all of a sudden, a big black... I don't know, maybe the fish got ahead of the Sharpies. Got a hold of the Sharpies, you think?
Well, I don't know. Do they have Sharpies in France? I'm sure they do.
Oh,
maybe
I don't
they don't
know.
Call them that.
You gotta have Sharpies everywhere, right?
Well, they might not call them that because that's a brand name. A black permanent marker.
Fine.
I don't know. But, Tony was wondering about some possibilities. And
he had some comments.
Yeah, he said that he'd seen that it was mentioned that this sort of problem can be the result of an ammonia burn. And I don't think it was in this situation because I believe that Juliet said all her water conditions were good.
Mm-hmm.
And so... Of course, if there were any measurable ammonia in the water conditions wouldn't
it
be good.
It would have shown up.
So I think she probably ruled that out, but that's good to bring that up. Thank you, Tony, for bringing that up, because if someone else notices sudden blackness on their fish, that could be a sign, one of the many signs of ammonia burn. And there are other reasons Tony cites. He says that when a fish is healing from an injury as a result of disease are possible too, but the sudden appearance in this case seems to be a bit of a mystery. And
if they're healing from an injury, they can have black spots?
Sometimes.
Is it like a scab?
Sometimes it can be, the scar tissue can be darker and things like that. And he mentions, if in doubt, maybe stepping up the water changes could be helpful, which is, that's nearly always
that
a good idea.
That never hurts, yeah.
Stepping up water changes. I know that Juliet has some special challenges when it comes to that because her water is not necessarily to be trusted, so she uses... bottled water for most of her water changes, which makes it a bit more involved. Yeah, a bit more involved, but in general, water changes are a great idea, so thank you, Tony, for your input on that.
And we are now going to Juliet. She says, the internet is brilliant, and when it comes to shrimp info, is finally coming out about parasites, worms, and etc. On the YouTube videos, there's a video of a shrimp with little white worms coming out of the shrimp's head.
Which
is kind of gross.
That's disturbing.
I noticed some tiny white things coming out of a dead shrimp, and it turned out to be small leeches. I had to dose the tank with an anti-worm medication, and then I changed all the substrate. I only had 2 shrimp left, but since the complete clean out, the last 2 ones are brighter red than ever, and I believe I might have finally found a solution to my problem. Hooray! In 2 weeks, a guy is going to sell me some homebred young red cherries for about 1/5 of the price in the stores. If these 2 last, I will take 10 of them. If these 2 die, I'm giving up on shrimp in the nano and will get a beta. I'll do shrimp in a bigger tank later on.
Well, certainly shrimp conditions are a bit easier to handle in a bigger tank, so that might be something. But we're just hoping that this will work.
Yeah.
Hoping that you have indeed found the solution.
Issue.
Keep our fingers crossed.
Keep your fins crossed.
Fins crossed. I like that. That's better.
Or feelers. Feelers.
They have antennae.
Antennae.
Which we can...
Call their legs legs?
Well, they have legs, but they also have swimmerettes.
Okay.
Yeah,
see? I picked a word.
And they do have different names for their different legs. There are chelipeds and pteropods and all kinds of different stuff for their legs.
That's a lot for a young shrimp to remember.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah. And they have 10 true legs, and they've got swimmerettes and different things like that. But we will put a link to that video up, if we can, on our site, on the page for this podcast.
Of the little white things coming out of the shrimp's head.
Right. We'll put a link up to that, or maybe embedded if we can do that.
Perhaps unpleasant, but useful.
Yeah, it could be useful. Now, this is an interesting thing, this idea of the small white worms or leeches, and I'm wondering what's going on. I have seen a variety of worms and creatures in aquaria. Some, of course, can be harmful, some not. But one thing that comes to my mind, there's this little voice in the back of my head that says, well, there are 2 little voices.
Oh.
One says, this may be it. And I kind of hope it is, because then maybe the problem is solved.
Mm-hmm.
But there's another little voice that says, correlation is not causation.
Is that the same voice that likes to say surface area?
Yeah, kind of. So that doesn't mean that this isn't right, that the worms are not the cause. It just means that it's possible that they're not. And so some more research would be needed to be able to determine definitively what the cause is. Because the worms could be there, taking advantage of something, but not actually being the cause. For example, the dead worms coming out of the shrimp could be opportunistic scavengers.
The
live worms coming out of the dead shrimp could be opportunistic scavengers that just happen to be opportuning, taking advantage of the opportunity.
Privateering.
It could be.
Proofing the Weasley black guts out, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it could be, I don't know if they're the same white worms coming out of the shrimp's head in the video or they're different, but just thinking that it's possible that something else is going on, so I wouldn't be 100% on this, but I think Juliet
through so much with this poor shrimp. I hope this is
the problem. Well, I really hope it's the solution, too, and I think she's being appropriately cautious about this situation, but I just want to put that out there. I had to say it. We're not sure, so we'll see how that goes. But I'm really hoping that you have indeed found the solution. And I'm puzzled about the deal with the sakura shrimp, why they are so much less hardy. And Mick does have something to say that may shed a little bit of light on this. So, but I really hope you have found the solution. And that removing the worms is indeed removing the cause. And changing the substrate as she did. Did you mention that already? That she changed the substrate
too? I did,
too? Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. So that hopefully will... at least the substrate won't be contributing to the issue. And that's maybe the solution. So, yes, I'm just excited that it may be the solution. Let's go with that. Let's hope it is. Now, we asked Juliet last time about her coolie loaches because she said that the coolie loach eggs had been developing. So she responded to that because I was wondering, whoa, are they black coolie loaches? Because I've heard of them developing in a fairly high pH environment, but I hadn't really heard of normal, stereotypical striped coolie loaches if they had developed well in water with high pH. So she has a response for us.
She says that they are the striped ones. She says, I once found a small coolie in the filter that I almost mistook for a worm. He was so small, but I never saw him again. They have therefore hatched a baby at least once, but the water is definitely not adequate for coolie breeding. I think that the batch hatched at a time where I had added a lot of driftwood to the tank as well as oak leaves, and therefore there must have been a lowering of the pH for a short time that enabled this to happen. It doesn't seem to happen now.
Well, that's it's that makes a lot of sense. You know, this idea that the oak leaves and or driftwood could be lowering the pH. Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. So I can now understand. A light goes on and I say, aha, that makes sense. So thank you for pointing that out.
So that could have enabled them to hatch but not grow up because it didn't last?
Well, it could have enabled them to hatch. A lot of times it's the eggs that are sensitive, the fertilization process somewhere in there, the developing the eggs that's the most sensitive. And once the fry actually hatch, then as long as there aren't, you know, extreme changes in pH, they do a little better. They're a little less sensitive than the eggs, because sometimes the eggs can't even be fertilized if the water is of the wrong pH, because it interferes with the fertilization process or things like that, or just development. But, or perhaps actually hatching out of the membrane, that kind of thing. But it sounds like it probably didn't succumb to a pH change unless it were, you know, it probably just was eaten. When, because it was so small.
Yeah.
But that's kind of cool that she saw one.
Yeah.
I mean, I would love to breed
coolie roaches sometimes. I
haven't done that. But it's fun to find baby fish that just sort of happen like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you find a tomato plant in the garden that you didn't plant and it grows up and it has really good tomatoes on it.
And you just say, yay, that the universe loves me today.
Yeah, it's that kind of thing. And that's how I found my first rainbow fish, you know, that I started breeding them because I noticed a few fry zipping around in the tank and thought, oh, hey, this will be fun. I'll take out some eggs and hatch them in another tank. And I did. And that started it, you know.
And that was great.
And I've had several volunteers, if you want to call them that, since then.
Volunteer fry.
Yeah. Or you open up a filter. I've opened up filters once in a while and found a whole bunch of red cherry shrimp babies in the filter. That got sucked up when they were really teeny and now they're bigger, but they've been hanging out in the filter and living on whatever detritus they pull off the filter pads.
That's funny.
And whatever duckweed or something that gets caught back there, whatever it is. So it's kind of fun to see that kind of thing. If any of you have other stories like Juliet's anyway, I think that would be fun to send them in. You have fry or baby shrimp or whatever that appear in a funny place or a funny time when you didn't expect it. Like my story of the zebra danios that showed up in that tank and I had no idea.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody said, you've got baby fish in this tank.
When did you tell that story? That's empty. Been a while.
Yeah. Anyway, it's probably been a while since I've told that, but it's funny when that stuff happens. So if you have any stories like that you'd like to send in or, you know, call in or whatever, that'd be fun. That just made me think of that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, and we were wondering too, any news on the darkened Indler's live bear? We're kind of assuming that no news is good news and she's doing okay.
I hope.
But we're just wondering about that. So, yeah, let us know what you think about that. If you've found anything else out, or if your fish has changed its status or appearance or anything like that. And thanks again, Juliet. Okay, and we do have one more, I believe, don't we? One more contributor today?
From Mick, yes.
Yeah, it's Mick in Carnforth, UK. So why don't you start us out with that one?
He says, I wanted to write in and let you know the fun I had keeping and breeding Epistogramma... Oh, you gotta say this again.
I'm just gonna... Cacatuoides.
Cacatuoides.
That's how I say it. Probably...
Cacatuoides.
I'm sure a lot of people say something like cacatuoids. I don't know. I just say it more like Italian, I guess.
Okay.
There you go.
These are great little fish, and you can easily keep a pair in a 10-gallon tank. I had 3 pairs in a 20-gallon tank with a fine layer of sand on the bottom, a few plastic plants, and some terracotta pots. They pair up and keep their own territory, just like any other cichlid, and also perform the great brood care that cichlids are noted for. I used to feed my adults on Tetrapro Crisp Flake and either frozen bloodworm or my own cultivated white worms every 3 days to get them in breeding condition. The males I had were a double red strain, which had strong scarlet in both the dorsal and tail fins. The males are not only much more colorful, but are also 3 to 4 times the size of the females. I fed the fry in Fusoria for a few days and went on to Cyclops banana worms, then mixed it with fine flake powder and decapsulated brine shrimp eggs, eventually going on to a mostly fine flake powder and grindleworm diet. The fry are very small and grow painfully slowly.
Hmm. So thanks, Mick, for that, because as some of you may know from last week, Charlie in North Carolina obtained a pair and was wondering why they weren't better known and so on in the hobby. and if we could talk a little bit more about them, and I hadn't had any experience with them, so...
Well, let's talk a little bit more about them after the break.
Okay.
Hello, this is Ken Jones of the Prince of Pawns and Pet Tech Podcasts, and you're listening to one of my favorites, the Aquarimax Show.
Now, there are more ways than ever to be a part of Aquarimax. In addition to downloading the podcast on iTunes, you can follow us on Twitter, like our Facebook page, subscribe to our YouTube channel, or call us anytime and leave a phone message at 801-477-0629, or just email us at info@aquarimax.com. And now, back to the Aquarimax Audio Show, the podcast with Icy Nelly.
So it sounds like the Epistogramma cacutuae, they are really fun fish, and the only downside, if it could be called a downside, is that the fry are very small, smaller than a lot of cichlids. Because if you're raising, say, angelfish or mbunas or convict cichlids, you know, different kinds, cribs, whatever, they can often take microworms as the first food.
And they're quite a bit bigger than...
They can, or a lot of them can take even the smaller brine shrimp as... newly hatched brine shrimp as a first food, but it sounds like these epistos can't.
So, they need much smaller bits, huh?
And not that infusoria is particularly difficult, but at the same time, it might be a little bit more involved than, you know, you're expecting if you're used to raising angelfish or something. So that might be a slight downside, but probably not much of one.
Just something to be aware of.
Something to be aware of, and the fact that they grow slowly, and that might be part of the reason they're a little harder to find than some of the other cichlids in some areas. Like, apparently in Charlie's area, they're a little bit harder to find. And I don't see... I've seen them in the pet stores a couple of times, but they're not the most common cichlid. And the slow growth might be a reason why commercial growers don't go with them as much.
Okay.
Can't turn a profit as much, right, if you have to spend...
You have to wait for them.
You know, a long time and a lot of money feeding them. So that may be why. I don't know. But they are really amazing.
Well, hey, if... the commercial breeders don't like them very much, then could you call them an heirloom fish?
I guess, sort of, to go with that garden theme.
Yeah. It's spring, you know, you can talk about gardens.
And I'm not going to say that there aren't any commercial growers that don't do it, because I don't really know, but I'm just saying why that you don't see them. They're not like bread and butter fish like zebra danios or angelfish in a pet store. That may explain why, to some extent. But I do know that they're very well represented in terms of cultivars.
Mm-hmm.
That hobbyists do maintain a lot of different cultivars of them.
Different colors and whatnot.
Yeah, yeah. Tons of them, and they're amazing.
Like what?
Well, like he was talking about the double red that he has, mm-hmm. and there are triple red strains.
So what would a triple red be? It just has red in more places?
It has a lot more red in its body, and there are some that are very pale, like Mick says he has a gold. He had a gold strain, which had red in the dorsal and then a pale creamish yellowish body.
Hmm.
So they're all different kinds of colors. And these colors are maintained, you know, in lines. They're line bred by lots of hobbyists. So it's not like they're particularly difficult to breed. It's just maybe not in the same realm of ease and mass production as some of the other bread and butter fish. That's all I'm saying. I don't want to be misunderstood there.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah. In fact, an interesting thing about them that I read recently is that they can be bred in... more alkaline water than most epistos. Most epistos need kind of soft acid water.
What are other epistos?
Well, they have all different kinds of species of them, tons of them. They call them
but
epistos.
But they're all cichlids, right?
Yeah, they're all cichlids. Okay. Yeah, they're all dwarf cichlids. In fact, South American dwarf cichlids, and the genus Epistogramma is really big, and there's all kinds of species in it. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are just known by their scientific names.
This might be a little bit off topic, but I have a cichlid question, and I know you've probably told me this before, but I can never remember. Classification-wise,
mm-hmm.
why are there cichlids in Africa and cichlids in South America? Like, why are they actually related somehow, or they just have some common characteristics that just kind of happen to both develop, and so they call them both cichlids? Why are they all cichlids when they're set from such different spots?
Okay, well, that's a perfectly valid question. I believe the current knowledge is that they are all descended from a common ancestor. Yes.
quite a ways back.
Quite a ways back, yeah.
Because we're talking like pre-continental divide here, or what?
I guess we probably are. I mean, cichlids have been around for a long time. I'm not sure exactly how long. I know that a lot of them have apparently evolved fairly recently, like the Mbunas and the Tanganyikan cichlids. Those lakes haven't been around for that long, just a few million years.
Where did they come from then?
But they all spring from one or a few common cichlid ancestors that came into the lake. So I guess the idea is that...
How would the cichlid ancestor have gotten over there if the continents have already split?
Well, they probably predated it. No, they probably predated the division of the continents, I suppose. I don't know.
But you said the lake is fairly recent.
Well, the lake itself is, yes. What I'm saying is there were already cichlids in Africa... Because there are cichlids in all different parts of it. There are West African cichlids and so on.
Okay.
There are even a few cichlids in Asia.
So they just made their way over there when there was a lake there?
Once there was a lake, they made them their way into the lake once the lake was created, which was a recent geologic event, created by means of attached bodies of water, like rivers and so on.
Okay.
And so then radiated, adaptive radiation in the lake. Mm-hmm. So going from one or a few species into many.
Are there other groups of fish that are like that, that they're the same big group of fish, even though they're separated by huge distances?
Yes.
Like what?
Yes, there are. There are barbs in Asia and barbs in Africa. There are arowanas that are found in South America and arowanas that are found in Asia.
There are
lots of groups of fish, actually, that are like that. So that's not unique to cichlids,
that's
where you'll find them in different continents. And arowanas, for example, are considered a more, quote, primitive, unquote, fish. So then cichlids are based on their shared derived characteristics and so on. We probably shouldn't go into all of that, but
this is the thing is because our oldest son is heavy into paleontology, and so a lot of our dinner conversations revolve around what developed where and why and how is stuff related, and so this is. I'm just thinking along his lines right now, I guess.
Oh, that's an interesting line of thought. And I am not, you know, an expert on prehistoric fish development and evolution and all that. So I wish I could answer your questions more specifically. I do know
That kind of makes sense.
Yeah, I know something about some of it. I do know that cichlids are considered, you know, a more advanced fish in many ways. Mm-hmm. Their parental care being an example of one of the behaviors that has, you know, evolved and seems to be a shared derived characteristic in the group. The family of cichlids.
Mm-hmm.
That's
interesting.
You know, things like that. So there are, and then you get all different varieties of parental care, though. You get the ones who are substrate spawners, you get the mouth brooders, you get cave spawners and different things. But you can find cave spawners in South America, and you find cave spawners in Africa.
See, that's funky.
And things like that.
Because they've already split.
Yeah, and...
And they're still in the same group, though, and they all develop the same thing.
And they may have independently developed it again, kind of thing.
This is why, even though we live thousands of miles away, we still like fiddles and bagpipes. There is things written into our genes, right? Like that t-shirt, genetically predisposed to the sound of the pipes.
There you go.
I will stop tangenting now. We can get back to live fish and not things that have been fossilized for millions of years.
Okay, well... It's fun and interesting stuff, though. So I'm actually glad you brought it up. It's interesting to me, too. And I wish I knew more about it. I have read some on that and know a little bit about it, but not as much as I'd like to. So let's get back to Mick's comment about shrimp.
Sad shrimp news.
Shrimp news, but it is sad.
He says, I was intrigued by the comments on Sakura red shrimp being a little temperamental, as my colony, which had been growing on well for several months, started losing the odd shrimp every few days or so. I used a turkey baker. Sorry, I'm having trouble talking today. He did not use a turkey baker. I used a turkey baster to suck out the odd dead ones, but suddenly over 5 days, the whole colony died off. All water parameters checked out okay, and I am at a loss to know what happened. Any ideas?
Well, see this, I don't know that I have any thing that I can do that would be super helpful, but at the same time I'm wondering if this might be related to what's going on with Juliet, and if Mick, you notice any evidence of parasitic worms or opportunistic
warnings. Not related to what's going on with Juliet. Their shrimp haven't had any contact. Just something similar, you mean?
I don't mean directly related, like, contagion-wise. I just mean...
Your shrimp and her shrimp have been sneaking out at night.
I just mean...
I'm sorry.
I just mean that maybe if it's the same cause. Same,
something similar.
Yes. And if he notices any parasites, because that could help fill us in. If that is indeed happening, that would be useful to know. And one, something that Juliet mentioned a couple of weeks ago sticks in my mind about how sometimes a species will, a mutation will have a gene that we consider favorable. We'll look at it like the Sakura red, the
but
very dark, rich red.
Something else.
It might be a vulnerability that's connected to it. It kind of sneaks in there, and I'm wondering if that has anything to do with it. If there's some sort of defense that shrimp have against a parasite, and then the Sakura red mutation seems to... Yeah. Because Mick keeps... I know he keeps several different kinds of the same species of shrimp. Because Sakura red is the same species as red cherry shrimp and Taiwan blue shrimp and...
It's just a further color variation,
yeah,
right?
Orange cherry, wild cherry. Yeah, there's just color variation. So it's a color morph, and maybe it seems to be the one that's the most susceptible to problems, and I'm not sure why. So that's interesting to see.
But condolences on your colony. That's very sad.
Yeah, it is indeed. I hope that you're able to rebuild it. He also has a comment, too. We've talked about how James Herriot stories come from near his area.
Mm-hmm.
And
we love those books.
We do. And he says there's a local magazine article about the origins of those stories. And so he's going to send that on to us.
That's nice.
That's very cool. Yeah.
We look forward to that.
Well, everyone, now that it's spring...
Hooray!
...in many parts of the world... and not all of our listeners live in those places, but many of them do. We would like to wish you and all of your fish and all of your inverts a happy spring. And to those of you who live somewhere else where it's fall, happy fall.
And our condolences.
But we would like to say, may
the fish
be
with
you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.